You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 15th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from Alpha Centauri, where they're building the wall and they're going to make us pay for it. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, Driftglass.
Hey, Blue Gal. We're going there.
We're going there, but they're going to build a wall.
Yeah, well, I think the wall is basically the speed of light. That keeps a lot of people out.
There's a lot of walls between us and Alpha Centauri right now.
But it's a good story.
It is. They're going to, there's a plan, anyway.
There's a notion to have a plan to get together with some people. But it's got some money behind it. It's got Stephen Hawking behind it. It's got some Soviet or Russian philanthropist, Mark Zuckerberg. It's going to take however many years to build the array of lasers they will need, Earth-based lasers, to fire at a cluster of solar sail-powered chips and shoot them out of the solar system at Alpha Centauri. It's a good old-fashioned concept familiar to all science fiction readers and lovers out there. And it actually works. And these little chips would go flying out toward Alpha Centauri. And since it's about 4-point-something light years away, if you're traveling at a fifth the speed of light, that'll be about 20 or 25 years, maybe 30, maybe 40, but, you know, a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And then presumably they would come within, you know, camera distance of our nearest solar neighbor.
And then they would beam information back to us.
Yeah.
Which would take 5 or 6 years to get back.
Traveling at the speed of light. It's not material, so it actually just travels at the speed of light. But, yeah, and it would happen within, you know, it would be a long-ass time, but it would not be impossible. This is not 1,000 years. This is not a generation ship. This is never going to happen. You can't even imagine your children's children's children ever seeing it. This could happen in the lives of our kids or our grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doable. I mean,
and it's awesome because it's space.
It's friggin' space, and it doesn't require, you know, warp drives or faster than light drives or anything like that.
Or freezing people or anything like that. No.
No.
Although I do think, Driftglass, that, you know, the word is going to come back from Alpha Centauri that, you know, with the Voyager last time, you sent it in vinyl and it just sounded so much better, you know?
Yeah, man. Well, Voyager hasn't even come close to Alpha Centauri yet.
No.
No. Because that was rocket propulsion.
This is different. Yeah, this is laser light sailing. Yeah,
and, you know, so. Light sail would be, you know, is to take a human spacecraft would be a slowly building acceleration using the power of literally the power of sunlight, the push of the solar wind, photons from the sun. But in this case, they're using much smaller sails, not incredibly smaller, but smaller sails and an array of lasers, just shotgun these things out of the system really fast. And they would, you know, they would still be driven by the lasers, which would not attenuate over any distance. They'd still be doing their thing, but they'd be able to push them out a good long way.
Well, I just think it's really cool.
And it's amazing.
It also sort of puts, as seeing the Earth from the moon did, it puts all of our petty human Earth-based concerns in perspective.
It does.
Which
is
helpful.
So before we wade up to our necks in shit, the election cycle, the dung of the election cycle and all the angry backbiting, I thought it would just be nice to have a really cool, uplifting space story. About here's what our species can actually do when we get our shit together and think big thoughts about great big ideas and big notions and things like that. You'd also have to build, you know, giant lasers, which is also awesome. And you'd also have to figure out a way to get other countries to trust you that you're not going to shoot down their shit with it.
Right.
But, you know, working through all these little problems, it's awesome. Just awesome. And on the subject of trying to find something nice to say about people.
Common humanity.
Yeah. Which is a pretty good theme for this time of year.
Yeah.
You want to talk about Ron Fournier, who on any other day of the week, on any other subject, we are diametrically opposed and think he's an awful waste of space and should not be allowed anywhere near a pen or a keyboard to opine his both-siderous crap.
Right.
However.
However, we have something fairly profound, in our opinion, in common with Ron Fournier. He has a book out about this. His son has a form of autism. And our son has a form of autism also. And so we want to congratulate him on his book and his son's graduating from high school this year. Our son will graduate from high school next year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having a teenage boy who has spectrum issues is something that unites us very it much is. So.
Absolutely.
And I mean, this is not just Ron Fournier. Joe Scarborough's son has autism. And, mm-hmm. you know, Sarah Palin has a child with Down syndrome. And so does George Will, has an adult son with Down syndrome. There are people dealing with issues. Wherever you disagree with someone, they are, you know, human beings and are dealing with something that makes them human. And so we, you know, tend to get very wrapped up in political argument on this show. And, you know, that's part of what we do. But we don't want to deny humanity. No. So,
and we'd also like to invite Ron Fournier and Joe Scarborough to come to Illinois.
Yeah, yeah, really, really. And come to Illinois and see what our Republican governor is doing to autism funding.
Yeah.
With his insistence on conditions to basically scrap union rights. And he's willing to sacrifice autism funding and along all kinds of other funding.
Museum funding, school funding, mm-hmm. funding for pretty much every social safety network and everything you could imagine, from parks to libraries, mm-hmm. just because he has an ideological notion of how the world should be. It should be a world where there are no unions, mm-hmm. and they should be broken. And he's a billionaire. He doesn't care. This is not anything that affects him. And it came as quite a shock, I will say, to the many, many families with children with autism to discover that when they voted as loyal Republicans for the Republican governor, that Republican governor announced on World Autism Day that he was cutting autism funding. Mm-hmm. And that they were like, wait a minute. No, 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 no. You're supposed to go after the moochers, the poors.
You're supposed to go after. Well, and this goes along with what happens in a lot of other states, particularly New York, which is there's upstate and then there's the city.
Exactly.
And so downstate Illinois is Republican, and they voted for Rauner. And, you know, yeah, he's just supposed to go after those Chicago,
you know,
welfare cheats and Chicago Teachers Union, which is a bunch of communists, you know. And we know what color they are, and we know how they're union thugs and moochers. And so we want Governor Rauner to make sure we don't have a tax increase to help those people.
Right.
And so what does Rauner do but go after autism funding, which, you know, all of a sudden there are Republicans writing letters to the editor of downstate newspapers saying, how dare he touch our program?
Yeah, the good programs. How come you're touching the good programs? So, you know, this is an open invitation to Mr. Fournier, to Mr. Scarborough, to come watch how advanced conservative ideology actually affects mm-hmm. people at the state level, where it is being implemented on purpose, according to their playbook, on issues that are important to you. Maybe this is something you want to weigh in on. Maybe this is something that we could work together on. I doubt it, but it's certainly a challenge that I would assume you have a giant platform and you might be up for taking this on. It's personal to you and it's important. So we leave it to your court.
And having, you know, Ron Fournier and Joe Scarborough have many more resources than you and I do.
Oh, yes.
To pay for therapists and you know, wealthy people who can afford a lot of private care for situations. You know, that's great. But treatment for autism does require the safety net of a strong community-based education system.
It does. No way around it.
There's no way around that. You need to have your child in a school-based program that gets them around typical kids and teaches them to play and interact and socialize. That is the treatment for Asperger's and high functioning autism. So,
and once you put
you
the
can't get around that. You can't you can't buy that kind of structure. It has to be in place.
And once you put the hammer to that, you don't get it back, because once you get rid of the nurses and the doctors and the therapists and the teachers and the administrators and all the people who know how to work together to do this, once you tell them, I'm sorry, you're all laid off, well, that program just stops and it doesn't come back, or it takes years and years to rebuild. And again, if you're around her, you don't give a shit. It's not your kid and it's not your problem. It's
well, and then you're what you're doing, though, Drift Class, is you're requiring, and this is getting really into the weeds, but you wind up requiring parents who don't have those resources to find a way to sue the governor under the Americans for Disabilities Act to get the school system to comply.
Right.
And, you know, there is no reason why a citizen of the United States should have to sue to make their government responsive to them. But, you know, ask anybody in Flint, Michigan with a faucet whether you have to do that. Of course, you know, this is the world we live in right now. So, and this is why, you know, we can say nice things about Ron Fournier and his son and his book, but at the same time, we are at war with any philosophy that says, well, both sides are equally bad.
Yeah, because they're not.
Which is the basis on which Ron Fournier has built his career.
Now, can I say something nice about Jeff Merkley?
Sure, he's awesome.
For a hot minute.
Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon. We love Jeff Merkley.
Yeah, who's the only senator, the only U.S. senator to endorse Bernie Sanders so far. And good for him. That's fine. You know, 40 senators have endorsed Hillary Clinton. Jeff Merkley has endorsed Bernie Sanders. God bless them all. Good for them. But Jeff Merkley did a really excellent job of showing how to do an endorsement without being destructive and vicious. He said, essentially, I think Hillary Clinton is an honorable person. I have worked with her. I have great respect for her. But I believe my candidate is better on the issues that are of most importance to me and to my country.
And he explained what those issues were. This was on the Rachel Maddow show last night. Yeah.
And he was in the paper, and he, you know, he made the round. And as an outlier, as the contrarian, he would, you know, show up on the radar a lot quicker than the 40 who endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed how you can actually embrace a candidate, endorse a candidate, promote the candidates, speak intelligently about their issues without turning around and saying, and the opposition sucks and they're awful and they're terrible people and can you believe what, and just dumping on them. There is no need for that. And because I think he's smart enough to realize, because it's a politician, that at some point the people that you are choosing sides against are going to have to come back into your camp, or you're going to have to go to them. And don't burn any bridges you don't have to. I know how exciting it is and how tempting it is and how passionate it can be to say, I'm 100% right. My opponents are demons and monsters. Believe me, we've talked about a lot of issues where purity became the defining issue and not, you know, it was impossible for people on the other side of the issue to say that anyone who disagreed with them was arguing in good faith. Everyone who disagrees with me is either a dupe or an Obot, or whatever.
Or Bernie Bot, or Bernie Bot. Clinton, yeah, whatever.
It could possibly
whatever
have
the version of Clinton is of that, yes.
Yeah. If your opinion diverges from mine in any significant way, you are obviously morally deficient and an awful person. No, you have a different set of beliefs. Now, where I think this idea of respectful disagreement breaks down is across the aisle, where liberals and Democrats have been painted by the Republican Party and conservatives as devils. Their common vocabulary among Republicans is that Barack Obama is a monster, that Democrats are evil, that liberals want to destroy America. And that's just their common vocabulary. Until they stop doing that, we can't have one of these adult pleasant conversations with them, because they're fucking crazy. It's not we don't disagree on policy. We disagree on reality. And that's a really important distinction between the two. So what Merkley did was show how to support someone without being a dick about it. And good for him.
And just to point out something we've mentioned before on this podcast, that Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Hillary Clinton, while they were in the Senate together, voted the same 93% of the time. And I wanted to get into just briefly a little bit of Freudianism.
Sure. Why not?
Why not?
It's tax day. It's April 15th.
The narcissism of minor differences, or the narcissism of small differences. John Fugelsang tweeted, "My timeline is full of Bernie and Hillary supporters throwing hate at each other over each other's hate. Good times." And yeah. I replied to him that he can Google the narcissism of small differences. It's an all-out race war between Swedes and Norwegians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really, what Freud meant by that was just that, that people who are in a relationship where they are, where they border one another, whether that's in a marriage or in a international situation, micro or macro, the more alike you are, the more conflict becomes about very small things, you know, and turns into a big conflict over small things.
Yeah.
And not that there aren't big issues that separate Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and that those can't be debated and argued about. But when we get into, for me, this is, I'm speaking for myself here. I am more than willing to get on a train with people who want to reform campaign finance law,
mm-hmm.
who want to get the money out of politics, who want to curtail the power of the banking lobby, the big pharma lobby, the military-industrial complex lobby, etc. What I am not willing to spend time doing is relitigating 2009.
Yeah.
And what could or should have happened in the Affordable Care Act. Affordable yeah. Care Act, right, mm-hmm. passage. Because that the passage of that bill was way harder than we remember.
Yeah.
And a lot of good liberals lost their seats in Congress over this. And I think we forget that.
Mm-hmm.
We forget how many times it's been challenged by Republicans in court. We forget people who do not would not have insurance today if it were not for this bill in our discussions. I mean, we just don't talk about that, those consequences. And so I'm willing to start from where we are now and talk about how to make things better. But to go backwards and start blaming anyone for trying. And that does not mean that, you know, I'm abandoning single payer.
No.
It doesn't mean that for anyone.
No, listen to old podcasts where it's always Medicare for all. Mm-hmm, always. Mm-hmm, always. That's mm-hmm. the optimal solution.
And that is going to be a huge change for our country.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's a lot of resistance to that because, as Rachel Maddow said years ago, changes to health care bring a lot of anxiety with them.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. It's as intimate as it gets.
Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where we're at. There is a debate tonight. We consciously decided to record this podcast before the debate
yes.
tonight. And by next week's podcast, the New York primary, mercifully, will be over. And I say that not from the standpoint of not being completely in love with New York values, as we all are.
We all are.
Bernie Sanders did such a great job defending his New York values on Larry Wilmore last night.
Uh-huh.
But New York is Rome, and New York is the center of the media universe. And therefore, this particular primary is just as awful as it gets from the standpoint of the media stepping in and making it about pissy little fights.
Right.
I mean, the one example I'll give is the panel with Tina Brown. I don't remember which show it was, but Tina Brown was on the panel, and they're talking about whether Michelle Obama would rather have had, I mean, it got to this point, would rather have had Vice President Biden running than Hillary.
Yes, yes.
And
it's very important that we talk about
it's
that.
It's very important we spend 10 minutes talking about that, because that gets into personal feelings and who really likes one another. And she doesn't really like her, but she sort of likes him.
Now, Hillary really looks down her nose at Michelle Obama. And you just want these people to walk into the ocean and mm-hmm. never return.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people who run the New York media, and they mm-hmm. love, you know, did you hear what he said about your girlfriend?
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear her friend insulted your mother?
Mm-hmm.
And then you step back and watch them fight on camera.
Yes.
And that's your story. And you have done the Charles Foster Kane thing. You have created a war in order to cover it. And it is appalling, and it is broken, and it is why Joe Scarborough should be airlifted out of the media and dropped into an iceberg, there to be frozen and thawed out a century from now as an example of everything that's fucking wrong with the media. Joe Scarborough decided – Joe Scarborough really is sort of my new alternate canary in the mine shaft.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not giving up my David Brooks because I've devoted so much time and energy to it, you know? It's I've built so many ships in bottles at this point. I'm really good at that. But Joe Scarborough is like – if you took David Brooks and dropped him on his head several times and made him much, much more blunt and stupid than he is now, much less guile, much less ability to lie with a coating of oil on it. But it's the same path. You start your life off as a conservative douchebag. You hook yourself up with a media job that you absolutely do not deserve. And then you use that media job to bully and leverage your way into a respectable newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Joe Scarborough, who's being paid at last report $77,000 a week on MSNBC, spends his mornings troweling out Republican talking points, bullshit, lies every day. And for his trouble, he now has a column in the Washington Post where he just won't stop lying. He mocks his MSNBC colleagues, which I guarantee if he were a liberal, he would be fired immediately for doing that. That's what happened to Melissa Harris Perry. I mean, she committed far less of a sin and she's gone now. But Joe Scarborough is protected. He's locked in. He knows somebody who knows somebody and they want him in that position. So now he's at the New York Times, or I'm sorry, the Washington Post, writing columns about both-siderism. Isn't it a shame how during the Clinton administration, Democrats lost their mind in the same way that liberals wildly overreacted to Bush?
Mm-hmm.
And people are overreacting to Barack Obama. And he is taking the David Brooks template of, all right, now that I've arrived, now that I'm a respectable media person, the next role I have to play, the next lie I have to tell to move me, you know, up the ladder is the statesman-like both sides are equally wrong. And he's just terrible at it. He just fucking lies. He just lies in the Washington Post. He just lies on television. And it clearly doesn't matter. In fact, worse than that, it clearly is part of the plan. It is, we picked a person who is a fraud and a liar and a douchebag, and we put him in a position of power, remove all accountability. There's no possibility anyone's ever going to be allowed anywhere near him to challenge him. We put this meek little, you know, Hausfrau next to him that he uses like a footstool. And let him run and let him go. And, you know, him, this is a guy whose show is named after him and who brags that his show sets the agenda for Washington, sets the agenda for lawmakers. This is what people watch in the gym at Congress, going in the Washington Post, railing against the people who shout and yell on radio and those Washington elite media types who won't listen to the common man. You know, and again, there's no one around to just laugh in his face because he is the Bill O'Reilly that MSNBC can't afford. And that's their business model. In the morning, they traffic in wingnut pornography. In the evening, they rail against wingnut pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their business model. So it's the entire media is broken, except, of course, with the Professional Left podcast.
Well, I have another example of sort of, I mean, that's sort of schizophrenia is what that is. Did you hear about Breitbart? Can you hear me?
I can. I don't. I've heard many, 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 many things about Breitbart.
Well, okay.
Which one would you like to talk about?
This particular story cracked me up, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this podcast quoting from a WorldNet Daily article.
Really?
Really. But it made me laugh very, very hard that Ted Cruz jabs Drudge for biased presidential coverage.
Oh, yeah. It's the Onion just went out of business. Can't
and,
compete.
It turns out it wasn't just Drudge. It was WorldNet Daily reporting that Breitbart was reporting that Drudge isn't real news anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's like crazy It's like a nested thread from Crazy Uncle Liberty's.
It's Uncle Liberty turducken. It is. And again, it is New York media. It is Beltway, East Coast Acela train wannabes,
yeah,
on the right. And you know, Drudge is the homepage for every Republican congressman, every teabagger congressman. It's office, you know.
And the Mark Halperin,
mm-hmm,
and John, you know, the insiders, the, yeah, both-siders insiders who will tell you what's really going on, read him every day.
Yeah.
He's, yeah, he, as he said, he rules their world.
He rules their world. Mm-hmm. So the fact that WorldNet Daily and Breitbart are now, you know, they're punching each other over whether Drudge is a real news site or not, on behalf of or against Ted Cruz's,
yeah,
presidential aspirations.
Well, it's a perfect reflection of who's a true conservative.
Who's a true conservative, yeah, Driftglass?
Who's a true? Which one of our completely made up propaganda bullshit sites is the true news source, mm-hmm, you can trust, you can go to? And the reason is really important. I think underlying this is it's really important to understand why they're fighting so hard over this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the, mm-hmm, chumps.
Yeah.
It's the chumps. There's an article by Josh Barrow, believe it or not, today in Business Insider, a source I don't usually cite. But he makes a pretty good point, which is the Republican donor class has been chuckling and chortling that finally they've gotten Donald Trump right where they want him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's tripping all over himself and failing to understand the basic rules of how you get delegates apportioned. What delegate allocation means, and how it's important that it's not just a body, but it's your body, because on the second or third ballot, they could turn on you.
Yeah.
Trump's argument is, well, the system is rigged. And they're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Don't you look stupid? I mean, don't you look so it looks like you don't even know what you're doing out there. You don't fucking understand. He's not talking to you. He's not talking to Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan or anybody else who runs this party. He's not talking to the Koch brothers or the billionaire donors. He's talking to his voters, his, yeah, base. He is telling them, see, I told you the system is rigged. Just when we get some traction, just when we get going, what do? They pull these weird rules out of their ass and say, oh, you know what? You want all this shit, but you don't get anything. See, we told you it was rigged. And that's the point. The point is, they're right. There are rules. But what you're doing is you're asking people you have trained to ignore objective reality, to ignore logic, to ignore facts, to ignore history, to ignore nuance, to suddenly become fact-loving, nuance-loving, rule-loving, reasonable citizens.
Yeah.
And like, no, you have created an entire class of people who believe the exact opposite of what you are now telling them they must believe. And they're laughing at you. Donald Trump's laughing all the way to the bank. That's why WorldNet Daily is fighting with Breitbart, is fighting with Drudge. Because whoever gets to be the trusted news source for these morons can write their own ticket.
Right. It's a license to make money. Yep.
It is. Or it a license is to run for president.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is a license to make money for a lot of people.
Exactly.
Ask Dr. Ben Carson. Yeah.
Well, and that's why, surprise, surprise, as if we couldn't have predicted it, Trey Gowdy is getting ready to do what all of those no-neck, mouth-breathing meatbags have been waiting for him to do, which is drop Benghazi, mm-hmm, right back into the election.
Yep.
Because it wasn't enough that Hillary Clinton went to the Hill and just humiliated his committee. It wasn't enough to hold 7 fucking hearings and find nothing. It wasn't enough to have a movie that tanked. It wasn't enough to continue to drill that dry well and humiliate yourself over and over and over again. Now, Trey Gowdy is getting ready to drop his final report into the middle of the election cycle.
Into the middle of the convention cycle. Yeah. This is sometime in July.
And my understanding is that he's not allowing the minority members of the committee, you know, the Democrats, to see the witness testimony or to see what they're writing.
They won't have a chance to see the final report or anything.
They won't have a chance to respond at all. It's been a witch hunt since day one.
And it's going to be a printout of Hillary Clinton's face, and Trey Gowdy's going to draw mean things on it.
Yeah, that's it.
And hand it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, it is.
That's what passes for news among, mm-hmm, these meatheads.
And well, so, and I was looking at Media Matters, that Benghazi movie that came out. Media Matters had a report that on the day that film was released, Fox News spent 3 solid hours of coverage over the course of the day talking about how this movie was going to destroy Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
It was a dead certain.
Yeah. And again, it's another situation where how long are you guys going to watch this network for news and not realize that they're lying to you?
Well, and
it's like it's Etch-a-Sketch every morning when you turn on the TV.
And that's why Donald Trump is successfully painting Fox News as Fox News successfully painted CBS, ABC, and NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Fox News's whole shtick, you know, Roger Ailes' GOP TV whole shtick was the entire media is a giant liberal conspiracy. And you can only trust us to tell you the truth. So don't listen to anyone else. Well, once you've sealed yourself off from, again, science and causality and history and facts, you're a cult member.
Yeah.
And they can tell you anything. And they have been doing that for 20 years. They have been telling them greater and greater and more hysterical lies. And those lies have been blowing up in their face over and over and over again. You know, George Bush is the great general since Caesar. No, that didn't work out. Tax cuts will spark the economy. That didn't work out. And over again, they've had to restart their own base. They've had to give them a do-over that, you know, we're not going to count the Bush administration. That never happened. We're going to let you put on funny hats, pretend you never voted for them. And now Donald Trump has come along and has become to Fox News what Fox News was to CBS, which is...
Yeah. We're going to tell the truth.
You can't trust Fox News. Those rhinos, the establishment hates you. They've scrooged. And you know what? Here's the problem. Donald Trump is right.
Yeah.
In this one, he's right about 2 or 3 things. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely right when he says the press is corrupt and they are in on it and they don't give a shit about you, because they don't. And he's absolutely right when he tells the base the entire Republican establishment has taken you for granted, has played you for suckers, has treated you like shit and given you nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of saying, and the solution is free yourself of this ridiculous Reaganomic obsession with tax cuts and hatred of immigrants and fear of brown people and contempt for women and that liberals are monsters, and come back to the real world, he just offers to take them further down the rabbit hole.
Because then you'll be a winner, you know.
Yeah, winner
and what is that thing that you said about in your blog about when you've been at the gambling table for so long?
Oh, the sunk cost fallacy.
Sunk cost fallacy, right. They've already given so much of their psyche and their lives to this lie that if they really turn around and say no more.
They can't.
You know who can, Driftglass? Mm. Is people who went to Iraq.
Yeah, that you damn
you
right.
Notice that the people that have had that kind of shock can come back and say, I'm never voting Republican again or watching Fox News again as long as I live.
Yep, because they've seen it.
Seen it and I'm done.
Well, and,
you know, and I've had my reality crushed, you know, my psyche crushed by what I've seen. So now I'm done.
Oh, I had a friend of mine who signed up. I haven't talked to him in years, but signed up for service right after Afghanistan, or right after 9/11. And he was going to go off and save the world. And it turned out they shipped him overseas. They treated him like shit. He came back. He went to work for John Kerry.
Yeah.
Because holy shit, were we fed? We fed a bunch of bullshit, bill of goods. But that's the thing. You have to personally be affected in a brutal and clear way that you can directly trace to the lie. There can be no way.
Yeah.
Pretend.
Like having a grandchild with autism.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like it is staring you right in the face and you have no way around this. Your flesh and blood is at risk if you do not change your ways.
And this is where liberals, I think, do fall down on the job. Intentionally, but there was a moment when the Bush administration had completely collapsed and the media was flailing around looking for some way to shift the blame to somebody else. And they were trying on the tricorn hats and desperately trying to pretend that Bush never happened. There was a moment there when if we had an actual liberal media, we could have interviewed. You know, we could have asked David Gregory to sit down and face the music. We could have gone after the media in a really concentrated and focused way and cracked it open and had a much more interesting conversation about, let's not pretend that you weren't complicit in this. Let's not pretend that you are not now actively trying to create a narrative that lets you off the fucking hook for being part of the problem. But they were allowed to get away with it. And that's where that's what brings us here. That's what brings us to Trump. That's what brings us to Ted Cruz. That's what brings us to Cleveland, which is going to be one hell of a show.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, I pray that it's not violent. I really do. Again, our common humanity. I hope no one gets hurt. I hope, I mean, I don't expect that there's going to be peace and love and unity, but, and I think they're going to make fools of themselves, but I certainly don't want anyone to get hurt there. And I do want to, we've got to kind of end now because we're getting there, but, and you have on our notes, Ted Cruz and the Great Dildo Crackdown. there's more to the story than that. Ted Cruz has had a very weird, bizarre week of coverage. David Korn took a bullet for the news media and wrote about Ted Cruz as Solicitor General of Texas cracking down on the sale of dildos and defending a law that made selling a dildo in the Lone Star State illegal.
What about a gun-shaped dildo?
And he
dildo?
Failed. Huh? Huh? No, yeah, really. Yeah. He failed at that. The court said, this is silly. But this town hall that he did with his family last night turned out to be very weird. Not only did his daughters come out and reveal that somewhere there is school film of him wearing a pink feather boa and underwear in a skit for the school, which, you know, I mean,
which humanizes,
just being
frankly.
A humanizer, going to be a good dad, but given his purer than thou, you know, Christianity is kind of a little odd. The story that he and his wife told, and I do not want to get inside someone else's marriage. You and I have talked about emails that we've gotten from other people trying to get inside our marriage, and it never works, you know. But these two folks, Heidi and Ted Cruz, were on TV and telling a cute little anecdote about the day they got back from their honeymoon. And Ted Cruz going out and buying 100 cans of chunky soup. Have you heard about this?
No.
Drift Glass?
No.
Unbeknownst to Heidi, Ted Cruz went to the grocery store. This was, they claim, the day they got home from their honeymoon, he went to the grocery store and bought 100 cans of chunky Campbell's chunky soup in different flavors and brought them home. And, I mean, my eyebrows are going up and down right now because I can't believe that they told this story, but I did hear it and I did watch the video.
Mm-hmm.
She said to him, I never buy 100 of anything. Why did you buy 100 cans of soup? And he said, well, you're not going to cook. And she said, I am going to cook. And he said, no, I know you're not going to cook. And so the next morning, before he got out of bed, she took the cans of soup and returned them to the grocery store.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And came home and called her mother, and her mother told her that was the wrong thing to do. And I'm sorry, but I'm having all kinds of triggering about this story. And I don't mean to laugh but at anyone's marriage or anyone's anecdote about their marriage, but the communication level the day after you get home from your honeymoon, where it's this bad that both of you have basically trampled on one another with soup, and it's not about the soup.
No, it's never about the soup. Well, you have both radically misread each other over something really basic about your roles and responsibilities and so forth.
And needing to send a message to one another in some way about control is pretty, well, I mean, whether or not it's worthy of comment, it was odd to me and sad. So that's all I'm going to say. I don't want to, I feel very, at a loss for words about this because.
Well, it doesn't tell you anything about what sort of president Ted Cruz would make.
No.
It does tell you that Ted Cruz has issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
as I said, I don't, except for the fact that they decided to share this story on television at a town hall when it was their opportunity to give America a glimpse inside their family structure,
mm-hmm.
that this was what they chose to share. And it is an example of, you know, I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a marriage counselor, but I've been through enough in my own life that if this happened to me at this particular stage of my life, having been through what I've been through, if someone I was involved with on a business level or a personal level made decisions for me in this way, I would instantly recognize passive-aggressive, nasty attack behavior against me in that.
Yep.
That's what I wanted to say.
Well,
all right.
And my takeaway from that is, when President Ted Cruz closes down every family planning clinic in America,
yeah,
all the pregnant women out there are going to get 100 cans of soup each.
See? Everybody's going to get soup.
Because he cares. Mm-hmm. He cares. He just doesn't care about actually you and your issues and what you need. He cares about giving you what he thinks you need.
Mm-hmm.
And here,
mm-hmm.
here's what
and,
you need.
And he also knows whether or not you're going to be able to cook soup or not, right?
Period. Because
so he's going to make that decision for you.
Here's your role in my... Right. Messianic vision for my country,
mm-hmm.
and here's your place in it. So,
mm-hmm. so do it.
So just do what you're told because Jesus wants it that way.
And he is very similar to Donald Trump in that way.
Yeah. Let's just remember this is the number one and number two people running for president in the party of Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Taylor. Taylor is 18 years old.
Oh, my.
And believe me, he does not have time for an adorable cat story right now.
Yeah.
So you need to go and look at him. I know I have said that. I always say go and look at the Internet Kitty at our Facebook page and website. Never before have I taken a picture of the Internet Kitty and actually pasted it into our notes to make sure that Driftglass saw a picture of the cat.
Before
so that we could talk about it. This cat is a living meme of cat that's had enough of your bullshit.
Yeah, Taylor had enough of your bullshit 17 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a very expressive face. So please go check out Taylor at our Facebook page and website. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go, Postal Unions! Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local. And we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box or chain retail store. And thank you for doing that. That does support us.
It does.
It really does. And we appreciate it very much. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. We'll also take this opportunity to thank everyone who donated to Driftglass's fundraiser for his blogiversary. I know you'll have thank you notes going out at some point for that.
I do and I will. We've
both been sick, but
can you tell?
That's going to happen too. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's been...
We've had the 4-day cold, so we're better now.
Well,
we're doing all right.
We've had the 4-day cold overlapping through 3.5 members of the household.
Oh, it's been crazy.
It's been...
But we're doing better.
Yeah.
So... And thank you to everyone who wrote and said kind words about my sister.
Yes.
I talked to her and she's hanging in there and gonna get through this and she has good doctors and good family surrounding her. So last week I mentioned that she's facing cancer again, and I just wanted to thank everyone who wrote in and said kind words to me and to her. Deeply appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. Hey, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties remind us all that as we walk that long road to November, beware of cruises and dildos and lies. Oh, my. Cruises and dildos and lies. Oh, my.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, lovey-dovey.
Lovey-dovey-dovey.
Let's forget
podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Drift Glass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Drift Glass.
All right, Science Fiction University, as I said on Facebook today, by the way, we're recording this on Friday, we discovered a treasure trove of old submissions that we didn't recognize as such before, but we found them. And so this week and next week, we're going to read these, and then we will get to the new submissions, which we have 11, and we are cutting that. That's it. We're cutting that off. Mm-hmm. So we have 11 submissions for the two science fiction images that have come in. And so those are going to take us at least 4 weeks, maybe longer.
Maybe longer.
And we're looking forward to reading those too. So let's get to these first four paragraph ones for today.
And next week we have submissions from MH and Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And that
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And that should round out the first assignment, which has been a great joy and a lot of fun for us.
We did have a couple of people submit and then withdraw their submissions and or decide that they weren't science fiction after all. And we want to encourage those people to submit again because both of those were really good examples of writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to discourage anyone. I know we didn't get to those two people and they know who they are. Just be aware, we read them and they were good writing and we appreciate that. So, without further ado, this one is from CZ.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the first four paragraphs. In the place of a heart, the QUUE redicer now came equipped with a heliorhythmic vacuum cell that blended almost seamlessly into its overall invisibility. Only under the deep, sleepy shade of the villicello tree, or once night's blanket had fallen thick upon the plain, could anyone notice the faint reddish glow hovering in the air that signaled its approach. Otherwise, it was the perfect weapon, undetectable and lethal to the extreme. Indeed, Lieutenant Anu Lark had heard the stories and read the warnings. He knew well the dangers. Yet he still had left the safety of his shuttlecraft that day and stepped out onto the grassy surface of the planet, armed only with a Gorthingian harpoon. Was she worth the risk? For the first time in over 3 days, his mind had been able to grasp hold of a simple, clear thought. It felt almost icy in its precision, like winter rain on his face. His mind reached for it. It was something to hold on to, like a thin ledge on an otherwise sheer cliff. And there, for a moment, he could rest and regain his strength and try to bring this madness to an end. What was he doing? Why was he here? Was she worth risking death and dismemberment, or maybe something worse? Being eaten alive and sucked up slowly through the QUUE redicer's narrow tube-like mouth? Chances are he'd never make it past the particular one that ceaselessly patrolled this stretch of lush grassy landscape. Programmed perfectly to accomplish its single task, to devour from the inside out like a ripe nangout bean. Oh, he'd heard the stories, all right. Any who heedlessly happened to set down here. The thought, cool and clear as it was, halted him in his tracks, and he almost let fall the harpoon from his hand. But she was a Kaelith woman, and against Kaelith women, men of his or of any race were helpless. All they had to do was choose you, as they put it, and that was that. No one knew exactly how it worked, but it did. It worked very well, and Lieutenant Lark could vouch for the fact directly. She had simply chosen him, and all at once the sight and scent of her had filled him from within, the sound of her voice invading the dark center of desire that nestled deep in his bowels, lodging itself there inextricably like a sea worm in the belly of a silver Binthian fleet whale. All his being had become the pursuit of her, without regard for life or limb. And Lieutenant Lark was clearly in pursuit of her. that was exactly why he was here on this godforsaken planet. All right.
All right. I have some recalls and I have some questions.
Okay.
First of all, I can feel that winter rain on my face.
Mm-hmm.
That's very helpful. That puts me right in the scene. And I can feel that sheer cliff. I can feel just that very thin ledge, my toe hanging onto a thin ledge on a sheer cliff very clearly. I can certainly see a little red glow on the horizon where this, whatever this thing is, I don't know if it's a machine. It certainly sounds like a machine
mm-hmm.
that's had components replaced. Which leads me to a number of questions, but you go ahead and do recall and.
I like particularly the moment when he has a bit of clarity, and he starts sort of almost talking to himself. Was she worth it? Is she worth it? That kind of thing. That sticks with me. The grassy surface.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaelith woman, and her choosing you.
Kaelith women. You know how Kaelith women are.
You know how they are. So, yeah, that's my recall.
Yeah, and he's a member of a military somewhere. Mm-hmm. He's a lieutenant.
He's a lieutenant. Mm-hmm.
I had questions. My questions were of the sort that, has he met this woman face-to-face before? Or is this something that happens across light years?
Mm.
And if he's met her face-to-face, how did she get away?
Mm-hmm.
If she got away, why would she come to a planet where landing on it gets you killed instantly?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would this pursuit have been necessary at all? What would have put her here? So, and is this a machine that's guarding the planet?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently it is, and it's really well engineered. So, again, there appears to be a lot of peril. And this probably belongs somewhere in the second part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also am. There's a difference between written words and read aloud words when you're writing alien things.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of a fleet whale and a descriptor that goes with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are a lot of words in here in a very short period of time that are clearly invented, which is just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Dickens had a ball with this sort of thing, so does Shakespeare for that matter. So don't be afraid of inventing words, but they will cause the reader to trip.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If they're reading aloud, if this is meant simply as you know, reading for the eyes, no problem at all. But reading it through a couple of times, I had to stop and say, well, how is this pronounced?
Yeah, well, not only that, but I think when you're inventing words as well, or when you're layering so many of them within a short period of time, it does trip up the reader, even if you're not reading it aloud. And I would want to pace yourself a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I know the assignment is 4 paragraphs, so you're going to want to cram in whatever you can.
Right.
But when you're writing out the short story, you might want to, again, just pace yourself a little bit. See where these words are, maybe circle them, and make sure that they're not getting in the way of telling your story for your reader.
Yeah.
And you get feedback from other people as well. Have them read it and see if they get tripped up by it. Excuse me.
It happened in Dune. Frank Herbert. Mm-hmm. You couldn't have Dune without the invented words.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely integral to the story. And I believe the book came with a dictionary of all the terms, a lexicon of all the terms he used and where they came from. They were clearly Arabic and Islamic in origin.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were. And they lent a really, really clear idea because it told you the history of the place.
Mm-hmm.
It told you that this was the 10,000th generation removed from our present time and certain religious beliefs or certain linguistic inflections had survived.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped the story because you understood what Muad'Dib meant.
Mm-hmm.
These words don't appear to have come from any heritage that helps the story explain why they're there, why they're called what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
So especially the antagonist, the bad machine, is a word hyphen with lots of caps and lowercases mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. obviously means something,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know what that thing is. So yeah. I assume the author will tell us.
And one last comment. Again, this is a frequent comment I make to these stories, is I want to know, Lieutenant Lark, what an average day was like for him before this happened.
Yeah.
So, and I need, you know, sometimes a writer can just put that as a hint in the beginning of a story, but from that little hint, you know all about this character. And the only way a writer can get to that point of being able to just drop little hints about who this person is if they really know their character. So, I also had a little bit of a challenge with the story in terms of the voice. There were times when this story got, as you say, a lot of invented words and a lot of very writerly detail. And then you jump back to the voice of Lieutenant Lark, and it was simple, short sentences, which is how a military person would talk and how a man would talk. And so I think it would be helpful, just as an exercise, to write a couple of logs, captain's logs or lieutenant's logs, in Lieutenant Lark's voice, so that you really get a sense of who he is and what he's about, and maybe what his story is or where he comes from or what his relationship, why did he join the service in the first place? What is the service? How does that fit in? And he got trapped by this woman and this drive to mate with her or whatever it is that he's connected to her in this way. That is the plot driver, right? That's the thing that's happened to him that's brought him to this planet that's made him go into this peril. So, we need to pull away from that for a minute, get his voice, get who he is, and then launch him on this perilous journey. Mm-hmm. Right? Well,
and one more thing. Those are all very good observations. One more thing. I don't know if the author means race or species.
Mm.
And that's a very important difference. In a John W. Campbell universe from Astounding, there were only humans.
Yeah.
Pretty much. The universe had humans in it of various types, but that was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
The aliens, such as they were the villains.
Mm-hmm.
So if Kaelith women are can choose a man from any race, and you mean literally a human race that has been, you know, split up and diverged and gone out across the stars, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you mean species,
mm-hmm.
that's very different.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you are talking about a universe where the species are men and women
mm-hmm.
who are very similar to human beings. And you've made a really important universe building choice and you want to make it on purpose.
Right. Right.
As opposed to, are there lizard people out there? Are there plasma creatures out there?
Mm-hmm.
Are there silicon-based life forms out there? No, I don't need to know, but the author needs to know. And
All right.
Keep up the good work.
And keep up the good work, because you never want to have just one book. You want to have three books.
Gotta have three books. And I'm digging this Kaelith women.
Yeah.
You know?
You would.
I picture a bodice being ripped on a distant
moon somewhere. Of course.
Because, you know, in space. Everything's better in space.
Bodice ripper in space. Okay. I don't think that's what this author meant.
No, I'm just pulling this author's leg.
All right. Thank you for writing. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're going to read Luke M's story, right?
Luke M, yes. In which Hansen had been dead for 2 days, and he was already bored. It wasn't that the simulation was imperfect. It was as technically flawless as the company's video brochure had promised. But nothing felt real. Not flying a spaceship, not hunting dinosaurs, not even the less fantastical activities on the menu, like eating or making love. It was starting to worry him. When he signed up for afterlife coverage, Hansen had figured he was making the best of a bad situation. The cancer was terminal. The company's presentation had convinced him that, from his point of view, once his brain had been mapped onto what they called their quantum network, marketing lingo, Hansen was willing to forgive. His experiences would be indistinguishable from those of the living world. The consolation prize for shuffling off that mortal coil would be boundless adventures and excitement, or a subjective eternity in the greatest libraries and museums in history, if that was his preference. It was ruinously expensive, but he would have no more need for money than he would have for his failed decomposing flesh. The problem, he now realized, was that reality was as much about reception as presentation. He'd read a theory somewhere that said the universe had to be observed to exist. Schrödinger's cat, neither dead nor alive, until you opened the box and looked. Hansen didn't know that he had or had lost a soul, but he knew something was missing. He couldn't make this virtual world feel real because he wasn't real. Not anymore. The box was open, but there was no one to look at the cat. The end. Okay, quickly, keep going.
I really like this story.
It jumps
in. It's a very good start to a story.
It does. It does.
And you were telling me there are a lot of stories in the 50s about people being plugged into machines.
Yeah, there are. One I distinctly remember, and it's always the protagonist is somebody who didn't mean to be trapped in the machine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember his eyelids being cut off and his hands being flayed so that he could grip the metal bars that made the experience real. It was the early version of a VR suit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds himself in a box canyon waiting for the stagecoach to go by. And it's all very real to him. And there's that moment where the machine breaks down and you realize that that the people you know are all just corpsicles.
Mm-hmm.
In a VR plug-in station, except this case, he has no body.
Hmm.
There's also a Philip K. Dick story about a predator who preys on the nearly dead, who are all in a state of suspended animation with their minds going.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different places you can take this story, and I would never presume to tell the author where to go, other than you've started off with a really good existential question.
Yeah.
And you've peaked, you've done everything that a four-paragraph assignment can ask.
Exactly. I think it's about as good as you could get. I don't have any changes I'd want to make to this. Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. So very good.
I do have a question for the author.
Mm-hmm.
If you have access to all the libraries in the universe, can you go to a library and look up what's happening to you?
Oh, wow.
Find out what happened to Hansen.
Or meet a sexy bodice-ripping librarian. Who
exactly.
Never mind. I'm sorry. Now we're just going down.
One of those tailless women that you hear so much about. It's a great start. Keep going.
It is.
I don't want to give anybody short shrift, but it's
no. When you've done something right, just go for it. And
yes.
And this is right. So and I don't know how many drafts you're into this because it is. This may be already a finished story, and you're just sending us the beginning of it. But it's really good.
Yeah, so. And this could be another 3 pages long, and you're done.
Yep.
Short story, boom, in and out. And or this could be, you know, part of a much larger thing.
Yeah.
But I'm digging where you're going.
Yeah. This could be a Phantom Tollbooth kind of thing where you go through different philosophies of death and, you know, explore what has happened to you and what different philosophies say. I like that idea of the library.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, science fiction fantasy books have used libraries as a trope. That's one possibility.
I have one question for Luke M. I meant to be provocative.
Mm-hmm.
How does Hansen know he's been dead for 2 days?
Ah.
Perhaps he's been dead for 200 years.
Mm.
Anyway, just food for thought.
All right.
Trying to be a good editor. Anyway, keep up the good work, and let's hear from you.
Yeah. Okay.
Number three.
Number three is Michael's, and Michael has a title for his story. It's called When Irony Died.
Oh.
I sensed movement behind me and ducked just enough that the Stormster's baton brushed across the hair on the back of my head. I spun and flung a leg out and tripped him. Like most of the black-shirted nationals, he was fat and out of shape and carrying about a ton of tack, the gear they all loved so much. If you knocked one down, he was like a flipped-over turtle, stubby little arms and legs waving around, trying to get up. It gave me time to scramble away and drift through the smoke and gas at the edge of the skirmish to continue my search. Silly as they are, The Stormsters are more than dangerous enough. The dregs and descendants of the old Threeper movement. No one knows where that name came from. It's not in what passes for history books anymore. They roam the outskirts of the dead zones in large packs, always in black uniforms, armed with surplus military gear from when the army was junked in favor of local militias sworn to support President for Life Lee. The irony was that these were the same yahoos who, a generation earlier, had armed themselves to resist government tyranny that didn't exist. Now they were the government tyranny, but irony had died in a hail of unhinged rhetoric a generation ago. The Stormster crowds had swarmed into the neighborhood just at dusk, grabbing anyone on the street for curfew violations as if they needed an excuse. In the short couple of blocks I'd traveled, I'd already seen two motionless bodies in the street and several injured. Through the smoky haze and glaring floodlights, I could see a group of nationals pushing people onto a shabby bus at the end of the block. I needed to see into that bus. Charisse had been out trying to trade for some rice and beans, and I was terrified they had grabbed her. Again, a Find the Girl story.
It is indeed. It is probably also part of our political podcast.
Yeah, the Threepers mm-hmm. and the Stormsters. Yeah, we kind of get where that's coming from. Right.
It's Stormfront
and Free Republic. Yeah.
And President whoever.
Well, President Lee might be a descendant of the Confederacy, or he might be Mike Lee from Utah. You never know.
Mm-hmm. It's a.
Hold on a minute. We're having a cat fight. Okay.
The only part of it that. Again, it's good story. I know who this person is. I sort of know what his dilemma is. What I would like to know is where this is.
Mm.
It is always more effective for me when you're in a specific setting that I can see,
mm-hmm.
a specific city with mm-hmm. really specific landmarks.
Yep.
Because a streeper, gonna creeper movement.
Yeah.
Militias in, I don't know, let's say Dubuque, Iowa. I'm reminded of the quote from Casablanca, where Rick is telling the major, well, there are certain sections of New York, Major, that I wouldn't advise you to try to invade.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because they will fuck you up.
Yep.
There are parts of this country that would go quietly. Mm-hmm. There are parts of this country that would mow you down if you tried this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be very interested to know if the author could pick the story up and set it in a very specific place,
mm-hmm.
Preferably mm-hmm. a largish city.
And perhaps an ironic space.
Yeah.
You know, there are places where you would look and there might be a lot of churches or a lot of, I don't know, Woodstock, you know, might be mm-hmm. a place to put it. And I'm just making these things up, but yeah, that's a good point to put it in a place. I'm interested, and I just want everyone to note that he wrote this in first person.
Yes.
And that really fixes any problems you have with voice.
Mm-hmm.
If you clearly know who you're writing about and you're writing it from their perspective,
mm-hmm.
I don't suggest that for every story because it can't work for every story. But if you're doing, storytelling of particularly an apocalyptic situation, it's important that the reader have a narrator that is on their side.
Yeah.
Or that at least can speak to what a normal perspective on things, the everyman that's looking at this horrific thing. There needs to be someone that can sort of speak for the reader in that world.
Another thing that it occurs to me, there's a story by Ray Bradbury called To the Chicago Abyss, which I've quoted a few times. A little old man who recalls the past in a post-apocalyptic world. And he can't help himself. He's riding the subway or he's on a bus or he's walking around talking about how oranges used to be and describing the dashboard of a car. And people hate him for it because the world is terrible and they live on, you know, soup can rations. And he's talking about how you could, you know, a Louisville Slugger bat, you know, chocolate bars as thick as those. And his descriptions were rich and beautiful and pissed people off.
Mm-hmm.
And your narrator in this story has to be pretty old because he has to remember, or she has to remember, all the way back a generation ago and then some, to when this wasn't so, because they're speaking as someone who hasn't fallen for what passes for history books.
Right, right.
So
they know the difference.
This person knows the real history, presumably lived to see it happen, lived through it all. You should really know the age of your narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Is he a physically or she a physically frail person? Because they're out at night doing something dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
They're the underground, or he's the underground. Remember the underground. And again, this is, you know, 10 paragraphs from now, you can catch us up on this, but was this person a school teacher or a librarian, businessman, a member of the brown shirts and fell out of favor?
Yeah.
And so forth.
And he's got some physical capability because he spins and flings a leg out and trips this guy quickly. He senses movement behind him.
Yep.
And he ridicules the black shirt for being fat and being able to be flipped over like a turtle with stubby little arms and legs.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly this guy's physically fit.
Yeah, and it makes sense because if you've survived all this time, you have to be in pretty good shape.
Right.
But I'm picturing like the stick character from Daredevil.
Yeah.
You know, old but very fit and very sort of hard-bitten and knows how the world works and knows how to survive in it.
Well, and he also knows, I mean, from the story, he knows what irony is.
Yep.
He knows who these people are and where they came from and why it's ironic that this all happened. So he does have a sense of history and, like you said, an age at which he can recognize all this. And that makes him a good narrator.
It does.
Because he's got all of the gumption and wherewithal to be able to tell this story. So good going, Michael. We appreciate it.
Excellent job.
And Driftglass, we'll be back next week with the rest of the stories from this writing assignment. And then the following week, we'll be taking on the picture stories. We have 11 of them again, and we're looking forward to doing that.
Yeah. And again, this has been a lot of fun.
We are really enjoying it, and we hope you are too.
Yeah. Take care, boys and girls. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.